It's the fourth episode of season 5, appropriately following on episode Radio Free Nintendo 443.
No, this is 443.
I know.
It is.
That's okay. What I said.
All right.
Right.
Because if it had been one later, it would have been the fourth episode on 444.
If you could use the same kind
of
accuracy
had four fours,
on our Twitter
and then we
feed,
been
that
crazy.
Would be nice. But this might be 423, apparently, by your timeline. So you're retconning the entire series.
Look, it's late when I update the podcast, when I update the feed.
It
and
wasn't
stuff,
you,
so.
It was the Twitter feed.
Oh, right, right.
It was our social media director, Mr. John Lindemann. That's your true introduction, John.
My bad.
Yes, I agree. You've also heard the voice of our sterling editor, Mr. Guillaume Vaillette.
There's a lot of resentment brewing under this, I don't know. I'm not feeling comfortable here.
That's my goal. Every episode is to make everyone uncomfortable, including our dear friend, Mr. Greg Leahy.
Yeah. Just wade into the quiet of the stream.
There you go. It's Radio Free Nintendo, and this is what we do, and it's time to do new business. And first up, I'm going to have Guillaume go up there first, because he's got some Nintendo stuff to talk about.
I do. So I downloaded the Runbow, which is kind of the newest indie game that Nintendo is hyping up. I've received an email to like my home address, my regular email
right,
from Nintendo. Like, they're really pushing this game pretty hard, and it's a pretty good game. But because it's kind of tough to describe beyond, well, it's a 2D platformer, I've decided, because I usually fail spectacularly to really explain what the game looks like or what the mechanics are like, I'm just gonna let Neil Runahan do the speaking for me. And he's not. Sorry.
Okay. I was gonna call him a jerk to his face.
I was so sure you said, so I'm gonna convey it through the means of reading out the product descriptor for Choaniki on Virtual Console. But, there's no good reason why it would think that. It's just a phrase, an attempt to crowbar in that reference.
Maybe we'll just make that the ending music. That's the permanent ending music. It's just us reading that.
Oh God. Anyway, so in his words, Runbow, the hook really is in its color mechanic, which fits right in with a psychedelic salt bass, I don't know, inspired visuals. The background color changes, bouncing in harmony to the fabulous soundtrack, and as it does, certain light-colored platforms disappear. Not only do you have to worry about attacking foes and timing your jumps, you also need to be cognizant of what color is coming up, so you can land on a platform that is actually visible. So thank you, Neil.
Neil is actually here.
I know. But yeah, like, so it's a 2D platformer. It's a very chaotic one. And as I just described, the background color changes, and the platforms that you're supposed to be standing on are certain colors. And so as the background color changes, as it, flips around or whatever, some of these platforms, not only do they become invisible, but they disappear. Like, they're not there anymore. If, blue is on blue, then like the platform doesn't exist anymore. If you try to land on it, you're going to fall. So, it becomes very, very chaotic, especially, in some of the stages where the colors flip faster. Then it becomes a challenge just figuring out if the platform that you're going to be landing on is still going to be there when you're going to actually land that jump.
Yeah, I mean, from the videos I've seen, just like brief little clips, you see different kinds of sequencing in the background of the colors, go through different bands and all that. I mean, he mentioned it being chaotic, but does those kinds of sequencing just change in a predictable way, or is it constant for a stage? How does that work?
Yeah, they're always going to cycle in the same order, so it's not random, so at least you can predict. But different stages, like some of them will only switch between two colors. Some of them will flip between more colors than that. And sometimes, like, it might be like the whole screen's flips to one color and then flips to the other color. Sometimes there's going to be, as you said, like bands that maybe like go up or down. Like sometimes.
Yeah, that's what I've seen quite a lot of. But do they feel like very tailored to the level design in each case?
Yeah, usually. Like sometimes I've been playing it a lot, and usually, like every time I die, every time I start over, like it's the same the same platforms are going to be visible and stuff. So it's very possible to kind of develop a muscle memory playing through a level.
I mean, because like when you talk about the chaos, I think I can find that amusing mm-hmm. in a platformer. But, you know, if it was in that regard, I'd probably have a difficulty with it. So, you know, as long as the level designs fit, you know, it seems like it's kind of a, almost like a clockwork kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, you could, absolutely.
You could adjust to it. So where does the chaos come from then in the usual kind of mode of playing it?
The game is that's its most predictable when you're playing the single player. Then you're playing the same level over and over again, trying to beat your best time. And so, like, you're going to learn the level and you're going to make it to the end. But then there's a, basically there's a multiplayer mode where you can have 9 players. So someone on the gamepad, someone using, you know, the Wii remotes, the Wii U Pro controller, like it's all compatible with this game.
And get what you'd need the GameCube add-on to get to 8 or 9, is that right?
I think that the Wii U can sustain like 7 Bluetooth connections.
Something like that, yeah.
Okay.
Plus, I'm not sure, I don't think, does the gamepad use a Bluetooth connection or does it use
its
own thing?
I'm sure it does.
Okay, so probably you can have up to 7 people with Wii controllers.
But if you really want to max out, you've got to get your 2 USBs plugged in the front or whatever.
So I played with 4 other people, and it just becomes so insane. You're not only trying to make it through the level, avoiding the other players, because they can slap you a little bit like in the Rayman, and... you know, kind of mess you up and make you fall.
What about
into
like
a
jumping
stage.
On your head, like New Super Mario?
No, they won't. That they'll go right through. It's mostly just you have to attack the other players to actually affect them.
So it's more of a kind of conscious choice rather than just physical gliding into each other.
Yeah. And also on top of that, you get these power ups that are they're not really power ups. They're power. Messing everything up.
Power downs.
Because, like, you'll have sometimes, like, I don't know, sometimes they're beneficial. Like, you might get a power-up that will allow you to basically smack a player out of the screen, killing them instantly. So that's good. You can also have kind of basically the lightning bolt from Mario Kart, like, just zap everyone else, and if they happen to be over a pit, well, it's too bad for them. But you can also get something that will flip you your place with someone else. And so if you're leading, you might find yourself in the back of the pack and the other person might be leading. Or vice versa.
Like if you're using the blue shell on yourself.
Yeah, basically. And, or, you know, like sometimes you might be running behind people, and if they all miss the power up and you grab it and it turns out that it's something that flips you with someone else, and then you gain the advantage. So, but there's no way to tell what a power up is going to do beforehand. So, you know, you can grab something and then whoops, the screen is reversed. Everyone's upside down and, no one knows what's going on anymore. That's part of the chaos, you know, that's going to happen a lot. And so we were playing this 5 players, and I was howling at times. Like it was just crazy. Oh shit. Like I was leading. I was almost at the cup at the end of the level. And then whoops, nope, someone flipped, switched with me. And then, you know, I lose absolutely unfairly. You know, it's complete bullshit, but it's funny as hell.
The chaos shared is funny. Chaos, you know, experienced alone is just rage inducing.
Yeah, well, those power
online
ups,
players know
chaos,
very well.
Chaos inflicted is pleasure.
Indeed, I agree.
So yeah, so you can play 9 players locally. You can also have up to 4 players play online. I mean, you can, like, total you have 9 players, but you can have like 4 players playing locally and then hop online and fill up the rest of the
spots. I love that kind of functionality.
That's really cool. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. So I ended up playing a little bit with Neil and some other people that he invited over Twitter, and it was a lot of fun. And
those 4 can be not in the same connection? Like it's not just 2 Wii U's paired together?
Yeah, sorry. Like 9... There's different configurations, right? But I mean, like, if you're by yourself, you can hop online, you can race against 8 other people. But I mean, if you've got 4 people at home, like, you all want to have, I don't know, you can all hop online, 4 people, and, like, be matched with 5 other people, you know?
Right. So it's not like, oh, if you've got multiple people at home, you can only connect. It's essentially, it's 9 people total spread across between 2 and 9 Wii U's.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Now on Twitter, Neil mentioned that it was kind of a chore to set up online. What did he mean about that? What was he talking about?
No. Well, you just create the room and you wait, and you have a 4-digit code that you tell other people, and then they input that, and
so it's
they
kind
join
of Monster
game.
Hunter-y is what it sounds like.
I guess, yeah. Yeah. But 4 digits is not too, you know, not too long of a string of numbers, and it would work well if you were certain that other people were looking at your tweet and actually feeling like playing Runbow, and you know, like, it's just like, if someone can't make it right away, then it might be a little bit annoying to wait for the roster to fill or something
like
that.
So could they jump in after you guys have already started?
I have no idea. But like, if you fail to get a private game going, like I soon after that I went and I played against random strangers, and it was still fun. Like, I still had a ton of fun, and I unlocked plenty of characters from other independent Wii U games. Like, I've got the guy from Steam World Dig, and Scrime Kitty, and Shovel Knight is in there, and so it's pretty cool. Like, you unlock tons of stuff as you play, and I was surprised at how quickly I got kind of addicted to even the single player, because it's got that time trial kind of thing going on. It was a little bit like playing BitTrip Runner game. Mm. And I was just, you know, like, every time I was like, okay, so I did beat this level, but I didn't get the, like, 3 medals that I could get. So I'm going to try to beat my time and perfect it. And I got caught, you know, doing that, like, every level. And it's a lot of fun. It's addictive.
Cool.
I had some people over. We played a lot of multiplayer games. But eventually, it's, you know,
you wanted them to leave.
We got a little bit tired of Runbow. One of us faster than the others. Like, he's very good at video games, and he was really not enjoying the chaotic aspect of it. So we switched, and we did not switch for the better, because we started playing Dokapon Kingdom. And which turns out to be like a troll's dream game.
I love Dokapon Kingdom.
I ended up not really playing all that much of it, so I did not experience firsthand all the dickery that can happen in that game. But I can see how it could get out of hand, you know? Like, you're all competing. It's kind of this weird, like, board game RPG where you roll a dice and you move spaces, and you're trying to accomplish certain missions, like get to the castle before everyone else, or, you know, defeat these enemies, liberate these cities that will give you money over time. And anyway, so you're all competing to basically rid the kingdom of these monsters. But you can also attack each other. If things are really not going your way, you can basically make a pact with the devil and become super powerful and just make monsters spawn on the board and just fuck everyone over. And eventually that runs out, so no one likes you anymore, and they're all just, you know, after you. So, it's at your own risk. But I did not, you know, experience that much of that firsthand. So I'm looking forward to playing more, actually.
Having played the game, it's kind of hard to put into words the ways the game allows you to just be a monster. Mm-hmm. But that is what the game is about. It is about being a monster. Because if you play the game fair, no one's going to have any fun.
Right.
It's really just a matter of who's getting up on who at that point.
Right.
And unlike Mario Party, where it's kind of a losing is winning thing, where, you know, anything goes and it's like suddenly, oh, you switched all your stars. This is more like I'm actively going to go somewhere, mm-hmm. and make it so this would be Mario Party if you, instead of Boo stealing their stars, you could make Boo just make them not able to play for 10 turns. And just says, you're out. Don't worry about it. Everything bad will happen to you.
Yeah, if people want a more detailed account of what the Dokapon Kingdom game is like, they can listen to 286. Jill in the Box. So you talked about this.
I did.
Before, and maybe I will listen to this. I don't know if you give any hot tips to win the game. But,
I think it's just ways to make the other person angry. So okay. I will say, if you're going to play this game, make sure you are the biggest troll in the room.
Okay.
Because if you're not,
you're going to get trolled.
Someone's getting up on you. And I brought this for 400, and I really wanted us to play it, but it's a really long game. It takes a very long time to complete a full game of it, and I recognize that we had a lot of games we were obligated as part of the the crowdfunding to get through.
Mm-hmm.
I don't, not because we didn't enjoy them, just that was, you know, we had obligations that came with how we funded that.
Well, we did not enjoy George of the Jungle. I mean,
we weren't obligated to play that. That was John and I just in the middle of the night going through the games I bought. Like, that was that was self-inflicted.
Yeah.
Was it Dayan Chronicles an obligation or whatever?
I was obliged to let someone else see Dayan Chronicles because people don't believe me when I talk about how terrible that game is. They don't understand.
Couldn't see anything. I don't know what
you couldn't.
Oh, it was so bad.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the best part of that game. But it takes a long time to play, so you need to have people who are going to be around for a while to get through it. And the thing is, as the game goes on, because it's an RPG, it opens up. The board gets larger, the enemies get stronger, the stuff you can do becomes more impressive, and the ways you can inflict just mayhem become infinitely more, you know, disdain-worthy.
Right.
So, at the end of the game, when you're super powered, you've got all this equipment, and you're just housing monsters as you go around, the monsters aren't a good enough threat anymore, so you really need to conspire to inflict upon your opponents the kind of things you need to win. And it inspires true just evil. I mean, that's really the best way to describe it. It inspires evil. And the thing is, like, I wish this game was available online, like, for Wii U. Like, because that way we could play for, like, an hour and then set it down and then come back later and play for, like, an hour. But, you know, I'm not going to be able to get four people together to play a game for 5 hours or however long it'll take to play.
Yeah, have, like, a group save state. It'd be pretty classic.
And you can't save, you know, for the local play, but, you know, when I played it with Carly, I mean, she was here for a couple days, and we played it for, I don't know, a couple hours.
Mm-hmm.
But we never finished that game. So if I went back to my Wii right now and loaded
best,
it,
James.
Like, I think I'm probably frozen, and she's probably being eaten by an ogre. Just as a guess, because that's what that game is. So, yeah, it's dumb. It's a stupid, fun game, and it's way better than any Mario Party just because it knows what makes Mario Party fun, which is when you get over on somebody and just says, we're going to make a whole game about that. Like, that's all this game is.
I think I might be too nice to play a game like that. Like, I was trying to win just, like, fairly and not be a dick.
You win by doing wrong to people you care about. I mean, there's a joke that game ruins relationships, and it's a well-placed concern.
I almost ended a friendship over a game of Risk, so maybe I should quit now.
Risk can let you do that though, so I can see it.
It's just priorities, Guillaume. Priorities.
John.
Oh, well, what are you asking me to talk about something?
Yeah. So we were talking about things that are kind of hard to see, like Dayan Chronicles, and things that maybe haven't aged so great. Well, Dayan Chronicles is never good.
Well, I have the perfect game for you then.
What do you got, John?
Sin and Punishment. See, that's the thing. See, I used to be the non-Tendo guy, but I think this season I'm turning over a new leaf. It's going to be all Nintendo.
All Nintendo you don't
keep
want.
Re-releasing Treasure stuff, maybe we'll keep playing the same games every week. It went live a few hours ago in Europe. I downloaded it, but yeah.
John.
Yes. Please continue.
Oh my God. Okay, so it's been a while, to say the least, since I've played this game. Interesting story about this game. I originally got this game for the N64. A buddy of mine went over to Japan on business when this game came out, and he was like, "Do you want me to
on
get? Do you want me to get
or
for
on
you?
Business?"
No, it was actually business, like real job, real job stuff. It was just kind of a weird trip. Like he was just sort of like,
"Hired
wow,
killer
surprised,
is a real job."
Surprised that he was going over there, and he's like, "Hey, man, I just happen to be going over there. Is there anything you want?" And I'm like, well, of course there is. Can you get me this game, Sin and Punishment? So I showed him what the game was. And so he came back and he got it. And he even got the adapter that you had to have for N64 games from Japan at that time, which I still have around here somewhere.
Or a pair of pliers or a Game Shark.
Yeah, whatever, man. You're ruining the story. All right.
All right, fine. Go ahead.
So it's been a while since I really sat down and played this, and man, this thing has not aged well. It's still.
Do you remember when I talked about Kirby and I said about how the sort of simple, clean graphics kind of come through nicely on the Wii U's display?
Yep.
Imagine this is very much not the case here. Ooh. You know, if you've ever seen the box to the game, which John obviously will because he owned a physical copy, as did I, but you know, people who owned it on Wii as an import, you know, download might not be, but you know, it's obviously very anime, but it's got this kind of, you know, detail, kind of lots of shading and kind of gritty sort of look to it.
Yep.
Well, and it makes the cardinal N64 mistake of being dark.
It tries to sort of bring that through into the game in terms of the, like, the textures on the characters and all that kind of stuff. And it's just, you know, especially with a game where it's just trying to push a lot of enemies around. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a big, you know, much like its sort of spiritual predecessor in a way, Gunstar Heroes, you know, that is an essential part of the game. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was a great choice, you know, because when you, especially when they use the in-game models in the cutscenes, you just get to look at how hideous they are.
Yeah, like the, when they show them up close, it's just, it's, they're hideous.
No,
and the,
not
the problem
fit for
is,
purpose at all.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the enemies, they try to kind of do these sort of like mecha-style designs. The very angular, kind of almost like,
Star Foxy, a little
kinda,
bit. Star Fox 64,
bit,
you know, a little bit like that. I mean, you do have people as well, but you know.
So let's back up a little bit, John.
Yeah.
If someone doesn't know this game, what is it?
It's I have a feeling you're setting me up for a joke. That
no,
I'm
not. I'm legitimately not. I'm just trying to give.
All right. If you don't,
I'm trying
don't
to be
know,
a good host, John.
I, you know, that's the thing, because you've set me up for jokes before, and I didn't hit on them, and I felt bad.
No, but this is the, I'm
this
trying
game
to be
is
a good host.
It's effectively a shooting gallery. It's what they're doing. It's a corridor shooter is what I would refer to it as. So
it's somewhat like Star Fox because you know it's an on-rail shooter, but mm-hmm. it's a bit different because you're not in an aircraft. You've got this sort of thing of handling the character. Yeah, well, it's moving forward on rails. You know, it could jump. It
yep.
could do a sort of strafe. It could do a dodge. You know, and of course on N64. It didn't have two analog sticks, so the character movement was intended to be handled with a D-pad. There's three different control styles, but this is principally, you know, you've got digital movement of the character and then analog aiming.
Yeah, it's right. And it's a little bit weird the way they map it on the Wii U because if I recall, on the original N64 controller, the D-pad was used to dodge and move to the left and right.
That was certainly one of the possible. You could flip it and have the C buttons do that mm-hmm. as well. That was an, but you know, yeah, the principally that's what it was.
Yeah, because the way the default mapping is on the Wii U, I think the target reticule is actually on the left
yes.
stick, and the movement.
But this
is on the right
but this
stick.
Is the beauty of it is that you can, you know, with another great. I talked about some of the advantages of Wii U Virtual Console when I talked mm-hmm. about Kirby. The customizable controls
yes.
is a big one here because this is definitely the most comfortable I've ever felt with controlling the original Sin and Punishment, which is not a great distinction because it wasn't that comfortable on the N64.
Right.
And
so I
just couldn't reverse quite,
those controls.
I kind of flipped around with the different styles on when I was playing through it with a classic controller on mm-hmm. the Wii, and it couldn't quite get... I felt like in some ways it was a little bit better than playing on N64. I never got anything that was quite that right. Whereas now... With the Pro controller, what I've been doing is you know just mainly kind of using the two back shoulder buttons, mm-hmm. ZL, ZR, one for shoot, one for jump, D-pad for strafing left and right and dodging, right stick for aiming, and that feels good. That's as good as this game's controls are ever going to get.
You know
I mean, Sin and Punishment 2 would obviously address it. In a very satisfactory way, we bring the pointer controls into it. But
right.
for this game, this is definitely the best it's felt.
Yeah, that's exactly how I wound up mapping it to. It just mm-hmm. felt. I mean, I pretty much just mapped it to what you would have for a normal controller with you know dual analog. You know, that's what I wound up doing. It just felt really really weird to have the targeting on the left stick. It was just incredibly strange.
I guess it was just because they wanted that to be the analog. And that was all they had.
Yeah. Well, I think they have a default setup. Yeah. Like they have a default mapping for the N64 controller, and that's just how it happened to map.
Oh.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but then you can go in, you know, to each individual game and move them around. You can move it around for the gamepad specifically, for the Pro controller specifically, all the different controllers. You can give them a different mapping. So it's
yeah.
It's,
I haven't tried it with
really
the Wii U
cool.
Pro. I should try that. I just did it with the gamepad.
But the one thing about the Pro Controller that was interesting is that, I mean, I had a Rumble Pack back in the day, but I seldom used it once the novelty wore off because it was too damn loud.
Mm-hmm. And it was heavy.
Yeah, I didn't particularly like the feel of it, you know, weighing the controller down either. And
it was
you know,
massive.
Sin and Punishment, I think I tried it once with the rumble pack. It's just rumbling all the damn time. All the damn time. So the whole game's... You know, it was awful, really, for that. I mean, less was more with that. But now, with the Pro Controller, you've got rumble that's a lot more discreet. So I can actually... And of course, rumble was not something that N64 Virtual Console had on Wii. Mm-hmm. So it's another little upgrade that's kind of nice.
Yeah. But yeah, certainly the enemy designs, they're just the graphics are. I mean, the whole game is crazy. The story is incomprehensible. I don't even know what the hell's going on.
Because it was always in English. Like the voice acting that tells the story is always in English. There was never a language barrier. But
ruffians,
I mean, to be fair, that start to skip thing is there the entire time. They don't make you sit through.
I'm all about the lore, man. I want the story. I want to look at it and be like, is this canon? I don't know,
John. John, besides making yourself punished to Lindemann, is the, so one thing we talked about, the design of the visuals here.
Yeah.
How badly does this game suffer from suddenly not having N64 blur veneer on a, you know, CRT TV?
Some of it is nice. Like there are some little things that I noticed about the graphics that I didn't even notice before. Really, like, you know, just like, oh, okay, that's what they're doing. Like, especially some of the more indistinct elements, like where they use like a flat sprite,
right?
For something, it's like, oh, I can actually kind of make that out now.
Yeah, I mean, things do look sharper, right? It's like
well, they are.
But the downside of that is, like I said, the texturing on the enemies, or the primary characters, if you see that close up, especially during the main game, it's not an issue because everything's going by so fast. I mean, it doesn't look pretty, but it's not you're dealing with the madness of the game. It's a very taxing game. But the cutscenes just really do show off, you know, how ugly these things look close up with some of the textures and all that. They definitely, the crudity of them is very obvious.
Yeah.
There's a few games that really seem to suffer from this, not to push us too far afield, but, you know, I recently got to see on an LCD TV what was that rare shooter with Jet Force Gemini.
Jet Force Gemini. Okay.
That's got a lot of the same problems, except it doesn't go by fast.
So was that Rare Replay?
No, I saw it.
Did you actually hook up an N64? Yeah, because that's a whole other thing. I mean, the native resolution of that is so low, and God knows what cable's being used there.
So on a Rare Replay, it's better, but not much. So
they've changed the controls, of course, as with Johnny kind of mentioned when it was coming up as a patch or something. So I am kind of interested to play Jet Force Gemini.
There are a few, very
sort of similar to what we're talking about here, but even more so.
Yeah, you know, there's kind of this weird thing about these mid to late-ish N64 action games where they
were pushing up against the limitations of that single stick controller design. It was, you know, like they knew where they wanted to go.
And the hardware itself.
Yeah. The hardware.
And to a certain extent, they're pushing up against the limits of their understanding of 3D game design. Like, you see them
Jet Force Gemini was certainly a lot more pioneering than Sin and Punishment, you know? I mean, Sin and Punishment is kind of an arcade-style game.
Yeah, they were trying a lot more with Jet Force Gemini.
Yeah, Sin and Punishment ultimately is the evolution of, like, Space Harrier. I mean...
In this case, he can't fly. It's Sin and Punishment 2 that's even more so.
Oh, yeah.
Because you float around. But in this one, you do have that little bit of, like, kind of making it feel a bit more like sort of third dimension version of a run and gun. Because you have to jump and, mm-hmm. you know, dodge and all that kind of stuff.
Isn't there some isometric stuff in, like, some of the Contras?
The Contras have various different kinds of sort of complementary levels. Like, you've got the ones where you are moving forward into the
arcade, what I always think of.
And then you've got the ones that are top-down.
Those things with the horrible Mode 7 graphics? Oh, God.
Yeah.
The Contra 3 had the spinny. The nausea-inducing spinny level.
Yep.
So let me cut to the chase then, John. And I guess Greg as well. Would you recommend someone acquire this game if they've never played it?
It depends on your taste in games. There's not a lot of game there, really, is there? It's pretty short. You know?
Well, I mean, you're both Treasure fans. Do you think it was worth the investment?
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah, I mean it's, you know. I can't deny that. That's the thing. Even though I mean, I find
because we've said a lot bad about this game. But...
No, well, it's important to know because I mean, but... I've spent my entire fucking RFN career talking about how much I love this game.
You have,
yeah, but yeah. That's not. You might take the impression of that to be well, everything about it, sunshine and rainbows or whatever. It's, you know, I mean, it's a late N64 game by a developer that wasn't really that attuned with making polygonal games, you know.
No,
and it does show, but. In terms of the gameplay, it's excellent, you know. And if you're starved for this kind of game, right, so it doesn't exactly hit the Star Fox kind of note, but it's definitely something. It's somewhat in that vein, mm-hmm. You know. This there's not that many of them out there that are really top notch. And even though, look, it's not that long, it's pretty beefy for a game of its type, but it doesn't have branching paths and all that kind of stuff like a Star Fox 64. So, you know, you play through it once and some people might be done with it, and then, you know, that maybe it's not the best value proposition for them. But if you really enjoy it, if you play it on the higher difficulty levels where they add in extra bosses, more intricate attack patterns for those bosses, if you get into playing it for score, you know, how far you could get, I've just replayed it over and over and over and over again until I could do it on hard with one credit, you know. So then you'll play it for hours and hours and hours and hours, you know. Yeah. So it's a bit of a feast or famine proposition in that way, and it's difficult to predict exactly where people will fall.
Your value will dramatically vary.
Yeah, because that was always a stumbling block for me in porting it. You know, I was very much on the fence. Believe it or not, at this point in my life in 2000, I had never played a treasure game. I only knew the pedigree through Konami and all that.
I had a friend,
Greg used to watch the Bills go to the playoffs every year. I don't know that guy either. So,
I really don't know.
I knew they had a role in Contra and these other games I liked. I had a friend who owned a Saturn and he had played some of their games. And he was still your friend? Yeah, it was cool. He actually gave me a glimpse of the game I'm going to talk about in New Business, but you know, several years before we got to play it. Yeah. But you know, it's I was like, God, they say it's so short. I'm just not sure. Yeah, because I'm importing this game. I didn't have any sugar daddy going to get it from Japan like John. I was going to have to pay.
My connections.
It was going to have to be top whack from English importers, you know, so you're passing on the margin and all that for a game that's a few hours long. It was like, in the end, you know, we went with it and God, that is the apart from maybe the original Smash Brothers, that is the biggest import home run that's ever been hit by me for me. But, you know, I had no idea I was going to love it that much.
I mean,
a lot of people
at the time, it was the game to import for the N64 because, you know, it wasn't released over
in a very real sense.
It was.
There was that game, and then there was that really tremendously bizarre Evangelion N64 game that people would import just because they knew the franchise. Then they got the game and went, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
Because if you've never seen that game, you owe it to yourself to go watch what the fuck that game is.
Yeah, but I mean, as far as Sin and Punishment goes, I mean, it's. I mean, if you can get past the, you know, the campy voice acting, which as Guillaume, you know, mentioned, is boy, oh boy, will you get sick of hearing them say stuff like,
"Please again, I mean,
continue."
You can press start to skip the cutscenes and all that, but it's kind of the in-game stuff that's a bit more glaring. Like some of the voice samples are like Saki jumping. Over and over. Oh, it just seared into my brain.
Yeah.
It's overbearing. It was like, it was one of those things where it's like, oh, look, we can fit voice on an N64 cartridge and the old, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should.
Yeah, it's certainly worthwhile, though, if you can get past the visuals and some of the stuff that hasn't aged well. I mean, at its core, it's a really, really good arcade game.
The set pieces are tremendous, even to
and
this day. Even with the madness of Sin and Punishment 2, stuff like the aircraft carrier level, will still astound you as to just how much crap they throw at you. Treasure, when they did pixel art, they did pretty games.
Yep.
And then, so you lose that with this polygonal game. It's not pretty. But, you know, in terms of that sense of spectacle and craziness and overwhelming and twitchy action, it's still vintage Treasure.
It is. It's a very, very tight gameplay. And it really makes me want Sin and Punishment 3 on NX.
I gotta say.
Yeah, if there's a Sin and Punishment 3, I know I am dead and this is a fabricated reality. the second one was bad and ridiculous enough, but that would just be too much.
All right. So, Greg, you tease us a little bit.
Yeah, so one game I saw running on a friend's Saturn in the mid-90s was Mega Man X4. And I didn't even realize which X game it was back then. I just happened to boot this up on the PSP. Oh, it's all the cool kids are doing.
We're back.
Absolutely, yep.
Not a go, admittedly, that drops the cred rating down a bit, but just a crappy old PSP with analog knobs been rubbed off that I got bought on eBay, because whoever used that anyway, certainly I wouldn't on a PSP game that I'd be playing. But, you know, I booted it up and I started the laboratory level, I think it is, in that game, the bio laboratory level, and this very familiar looking sort of spiral staircase with the glass in the middle. It's like, I've seen this before, and then I remembered my friend showing me a Mega Man game that I didn't really know what it was nearly 20 years before, and I realised the connection between the two. But of course, since then, I've played Mega Man X and X2 on the Wii Virtual Console. I really enjoyed those. Some of my favourite Virtual Console games to catch up on. But I haven't played 3 yet, because they did get around to bringing that out on Wii U. There was a kind of Capcom, wasn't it last year, wasn't it, in the summer? They had a big sort of mop-up of the big games they didn't release on Wii for whatever bloody reason. So we got Demon's Crest, we got Mega Man 7, we got Mega Man X3. You know, so they've, for whatever reason, decided to get around to this finally. But I have not played X3 yet. Any thoughts, James, on the
I've played all of the X games except for the 3D one with Bamboo Pandemonium. I can't bring myself to play a game where one of the bosses is Bamboo Pandemonium. I've played X4 especially a lot, because I think it's my favorite. To the point where you said, oh, I was in the Biolab tour, and oh, Split Mushroom.
Is that Split Mushroom?
Not only this, I immediately thought, he occupies the laboratory and will attack whoever visits there.
I love that. I love the silly
like,
days.
I have played this game so many times that I know...
To be fair, let's not dance around the fact this has some pretty bloody similar names. Not maybe Bamboo Pandemonium.
Jet Stingray's bad. Jet Stingray's bad.
I mean, like, from the people that brought you
Boom... He destroyed the city and escaped to the sea, by the way.
In the second one, you've got Boomer Kawanga.
Yeah.
In this one, it's like they kind of thought we could one-up that with Cyber Kujaka.
Wait, really? So in at least in the North American version, he's called Cyber Peacock.
Yeah, I'm playing the Japanese one.
Really?
Yeah, I got this off the Japanese PSN.
Are exotic, Greg, always.
I had credit on that account.
He lives in cyberspace and wants to destroy the network.
Awesome. So wait a minute, you're telling me that those spiels made it into the North American version?
Yeah.
That's even better.
Because they weren't text, they were part of the animation. So
They
would have to remake the animation, and F that, that's not happening.
Why was that even in English in the first place? I don't know, but...
I mean, it was barely in English.
X4, I've been impressed with it, but I mean, the main... I have a soft spot for stuff that's basically 16-bit graphics, but prettier. Fundamentally very similar. It's like Neo Geo games, some of the earlier 32-bit games that were still, you know, in this sort of, like some of the things that Treasure did, a Silhouette Mirage. You know, it does look very nice. There's a few pre-rendered looking elements
especially in the Cyber Peacock stage. But
yeah,
they were playing that up though. They're like, look how computer generated this looks.
Yeah, it is the cyber level, which has a weird thing about timing you, and you have to get a certain grade to pass through.
There's gates like it's a racing game, and the faster you get through it, the better your score, and that's how you get the bonuses in that stage, like the heart tanks and stuff.
It's an interesting wrinkle, but I mean, the biggest thing with this one, and I don't think this was in X3, but I haven't played that, so I don't have
What is all of this shit that I've pushed out of my brain to know this game?
Is being able to play Zero.
Yes, in X3 you could play as Zero for these little brief windows, but never fight a boss. Because you could get his Z-Saber through doing this really complicated thing, and it one-hit kills everything.
So they had to keep that away from possibly being used against the boss.
In 4, you could play him full-time.
Yeah, I've played the entire game as Zero, and I'm pretty near the end now. Maybe the first of several forms of the last boss, maybe. Or maybe there's another one after that, you know, twisty-turny, these Mega Man
He's
stories.
He's got at least two.
But, you know, having played it all the way to, it's different. Obviously, Zero is a kind of melee character. But the biggest difference is when you fight a boss, you kill a boss, the ability you get is not something that you, a gun that you sort of cycle through using the shoulder buttons to get to, the way that, you know, you might think of with Mega Man. You know, you actually get these sort of abilities. You might get like a down thrust from the ice boss, or
right,
an up thrust from the fire boss, and you get, the air dash and all this kind of stuff. You know, so you're really kind of,
yeah,
just
some of them aren't even attacks.
Yeah, exactly. They're just physical upgrades. So which obviously, you know, have been in Mega Man X games before, but with Zero, his entire progression is just more physical, basically. You know, and you're not like cycling through guns on bosses to kind of catch them out with weak points or whatever. And I quite like that. I mean, I guess it's because I've played a couple of these before. You know, it felt more fresh, as a result, being able to play it straight. I didn't really even start with Mega Man. I just, oh, Zero, I'll just go straight to that, you know, and it's been a lot of fun playing with him. I've really enjoyed it.
Actually, one of the things about that where they didn't translate is they didn't bother to change any of the attack names. So, like, it's still called like Shippuga and Rakuhoa. But like, you get to hear the announcers say it, you're like, what is happening right now? Like, is there something playing about? I mean, to your point about this game being a 32-bit game, the sprites are way more complicated and they have way more depth of color than a Super Nintendo game could manage. But also, yeah, just the animations are more complex.
Yes. I love the smoothness, and it really does kind of feel like a 16-bit game, but sort of given some kind of injection to bring it more to life, you know, like,
yeah,
just to be more vibrant and more fluid. And there's something about that kind of look that really just
and with Zero, that makes a huge difference, because
yeah,
so much of him is about this fluid motion, even his stupid ponytail.
Oh yeah, his hair
flapping
coming out
in the
back,
wind as he yeah runs. Yeah.
I love the kind of air slash thing he does. You get that where it almost becomes like a screw attack.
Yes.
You're in the air and you're swinging around, and that's really, once you, at first it's kind of like, okay, it's cool playing as a melee character to some extent, but it does feel a bit limiting. But by the time you actually get all of these abilities, there's a lot more. There is a
like
genuine feeling of empowerment
like
there.
That.
You really do like feel like you can mess up everything in quick time.
I think to me, the point where this game made the turn to being my favorite X game is in the Jet Stingray stage, where most of the stage you're just pursuing him on a jet bike.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of a Contra stage, like that was set on the jet bike, and then you jump on the missiles. Like, you know, you have a game that's quite, you know, very kind of just usual sort of pace to it, and then this one level just totally changes the pacing.
Right, and the game has some ways you can cheese it too, so that's fun. Like, there is something about Mega Man games, especially when you find ways to cheese the game out, is kind of satisfying. Because so much of that game comes down to attrition sometimes, where you really have to get in there as best you can when you're about to go do a rundown with the boss. So,
yeah, set yourself up. Obviously, you got, yeah, the E-tanks and all that kind of stuff. You know, I mean, if you wanted to kind of really, and regenerating enemies, so if you really wanted to kind of grind your way to that, you know, to help you, you can, but I generally try to avoid that because it's just more immiserating than it is convenient.
Yeah, and you only get one shot at it. So if it doesn't,
sure,
go,
yeah,
if it doesn't go well, guess what?
No, it's kind of like, I've not tried to fill it up, but I might have a little bit left, and I've not used it unless it's like, okay, I'm doing quite well here. I don't, you know, but let's just give myself a little bit of help just in case I blow it, because I'd be really annoyed otherwise.
I definitely, the first time I beat Sigma, like, filled up all four of the tanks. Like, because I was going in there and I was going to do business, and that was going to be the end of it. And that is how you do some business. But, I mean, this game, I just like the fluidness and how it all works really beautifully. And X5, things start to go sideways. I like X3 a lot. I think for a Super Nintendo
game. Yeah, because that's got a bit of a bad rap, around when you read up on the series relatively. You know, the 4 is regarded as an uptick, you know,
right.
That was when it got better again. And then, like, 6, which just came out on, 6 that just came out on the Japanese PSN has a really bad reputation
from all
the stuff I've seen. So,
6 is tough to get through.
It's kind of weird, like, you know, whether I feel the need to play 3 or not. Because I was always more interested in 4 because it brings Zero in and because it's just meant to be another of the high points of the series.
I like 3. It is definitely a Super Nintendo game, though. And even the PlayStation version of it is a Super Nintendo game.
They're kind of buffed remake, ports.
Yeah. Whereas this game was, you know, originally developed for the Saturn and the PlayStation. And it shows everywhere. And including in its videos that are infamous.
And including the Independence Day ships shooting in one of the levels, like that dates it. Because it came out in 97, which is like the year after. Every game that came out in 97 had to have an ID4 reference.
It did. This is where the infamous Iris screaming comes from and the bad voice acting.
I think I just saw that bit.
Oh, it's terrible. It's real bad. And,
but obviously, I mean, this is Japanese. Did it have North American voice acting?
Oh, yeah, it's awful.
It was probably muted, but it was still funny, like, the big
like,
cry.
Like, all the voice acting in this game is another level bad. Like, it's stultifying when you hear it. You're thinking, because there's this weird, because it's, you could tell that video like this was still new, and they didn't quite understand how to do it. So, when the colonel is up there giving his slightly fascist speech to his army, and you're thinking to yourself, this is a little bit Germany 1930s. I'm not feeling good about this. You could tell that scene was much faster. Well, it's not any faster, but you could tell that the text was much faster to say in the Japanese version. So he's having to talk super fast.
Oh, man.
And because there's no mouth, they don't have to do any ADR, but, like, he's got to get through his whole line real quick. So he's like, "Come the future of the Republic, here we go!" And you're like, "What the fuck is happening right now?" It's a fascinating game in a lot of ways, and I really enjoy it. And I'm glad you've gotten to play it because it's stupid, but it's
no. I'd been looking forward to this for quite a while, and it finally, you know, Capcom, for whatever reason, you know, middle of last year, at the same time we talked about, like, Mega Man 7, all that, so on PSN in Japan, and I think, you know, mostly in America anyway, I'm not sure about Europe, they put out stuff like, you know, Trombone, X4-5, you know, they just saw the light and started bringing, you know, I mean, this is during the age of the PS4 that they finally started releasing this stuff on, you know, PSN. I don't know why they took so long, but I'm glad they did.
Mm.
Mm. Well, and it's not playable on PS4, by the way.
No.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
As is the way a lot of these games.
Well, I suppose there is the fact that hardly anyone in Japan owns a PS4, so it's
that is a true point. All right, so I'm going to wrap up new business this week. I give a quick update on LBX, Little Battler Experience. I talked about it last week. I talked about how this feels like the ultimate representation of Treasure. I mean, sorry, God, we spoke about Treasure so much that this feels like the ultimate representation of Level 5 doing their transmedia property. And the deeper I get into this game, the more I feel that way. Like, they've introduced Gashapon, and the only place in the entire game you can spend money is in the store where they sell LBX parts and the Gashapon for LBX right outside of it. Like, they're really trying to drive this point home of, hey, kids, you can buy toys or figurines or this playing card game we've made based around it. Just ask your parents. There's a store down the street that's got them in stock. Go, go, go. But the game itself hasn't really progressed that much. When I talked about it last week, I probably tacked on another 6 or 7 hours. It's, you know, it's still kind of giving me these episodic story bits where, you know, it's go here, go here, go here, go here. Fight the boss's lackeys. Fight the boss. Your fight with the boss gets interrupted by events going on around you. We'll meet again next time. Like, that, it's really kind of following that progression and just escalating the terms under which your team is operating against this comedically evil operation. To the point where now it's just like, all right, we're going to go to the world tournament because why aren't we? And that's where we're going to have our showdown because why wouldn't you? Because when we broke into your house to try to rescue a hostage, your nephew showed up and we had a fight And then it got interrupted by security because why wouldn't it? And then we'll meet again next time. Like, to the point where now it's just reached a point like, are there no police departments in this community, or do we have to rely on children with toys to settle all of our differences? So it's really the most level 5 game I've ever played. And that's saying something, because in Inazuma 11, like I said, kids kick dragons at each other and put the fate while under the effect of hypnosis and while fighting ninjas over the fate of the free world. I mean, this is they're really following their mode here. So,
are you excited for Yo-Kai Watch that's got a date this year?
I'm curious, because Yo-Kai Watch is sort of the ultimate expression of the transmedia property.
Yeah, that's when you said that, I'm like, well,
what is it, polymorphic content? Isn't that over?
Yeah,
like you said that, I was like, well, yeah, that's come out in America to this point, there's another one coming.
There's this weird like progression of, you can see them getting more and more insidious about this. Like in Inazuma 11, there wasn't so much they could do. They could make some toys, but primarily they did it through like manga and movies and stuff and TV shows. But now you've reached this point where like LBX is totally built around toys, which makes it super easy to make toys. It's like Transformers without the artifice of them being alive. It's just right to the point. Yo-Kai Watch has said, man, that Pokemon thing. Let's do that times 10. So, yeah, I'm excited, but somewhat, not excited, might have been curious.
Interested.
Not like that, John.
This is just,
a fatal curiosity.
Your curiosity makes me laugh because I have a feeling it's going to get you into trouble.
Well, but see, I don't pretend to buy the crap that goes with it.
Like,
if I was like 10 when LBX came out, I'd be over the moon. Like, I'd be watching the dumb show. I would be buying just the toys.
Channel your inner 10-year-old, James. It's not too far away.
It's fine. I killed him because when we talk about my inner childishness, we're going to talk about a game. So the summer of no games brought to you by Nintendo of America took a weak return because
it's too hot for games, man. Too hot.
too hot for games. Excuse me. The summer of too hot for games.
Hot takes.
Had a weak return because, again, this was a week Nintendo took off. Nintendo of America, at least. And so I pulled out Perpetual RFN Punchline, GameCube racing game from the future with hovercraft tube slider. So a couple points to make. A couple really important points to make about this game.
Did you make yourself a tube steak while you had a tube slider?
Are you done? Are you done, John?
I'm done. Continue. I'll laugh
over
here.
For some reason, I find it more risible that the title is Tube Slider Singular.
Yeah.
That
was the first thing I was going to talk about. All these years, we've been calling it Tube Sliders, and we've been mistaken. It's Tube Slider Singular.
I'll be over here laughing. I'm just going to mute myself. I'll be right back.
Just go slide some tubes, John. It'll be fine. So what this game is it is a... It's your standard futuristic hovercraft racer where everything's going super fast, but it's in tubes. That's it. There's no branching paths. There's no course outs. It's just tubes. So you can go up and around the tube. Sometimes you'll kind of fall off and land back down. The tube like changes directions quickly, but primarily you're just on a tube racing. And I put up the video for this one already. And just a quick apology on that one. That game had some bizarre desire to in no way, shape, or form be recorded.
It's a video gaming vampire. It's
pretty
image
much.
Cannot be captured.
So the first capture was just pixels, which is weird. It was fine until I went to the tutorial mode, which is just hyper-compressed GameCube video. And that seemed to have just freaked the capture device out. Which is appropriate, because it's the most compressed video I've ever seen on the GameCube. It's like almost N64 RE2.
More than GX's little video story mode?
It's borderline RE2 on the N64. It's bad. It's a disaster. And then they covered it by making it like only like one-fifth of the 4:3 screen. So 480i.
But pretty much a mega CD type of stuff.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. But then multiple captures, the audio got really out of sync. It's like, what on earth is with this stupid game? But regardless, so the game only really has two modes, which is essentially time trials and the Grand Prix. And it's got, so essentially there's seven racetracks, but the Grand Prix works as like level one, level two, level three, and it's 3, 5, 7 tracks. So the first level of it is so comedically easy, I didn't steer for a race and got first place. I just held down the accelerator and went.
So it's like Kirby Air Ride.
Kirby Air Ride,
it's release A to win, because sometimes you need to break. This game is just like, I'm just going to go.
Is that the 200cc version of Kirby's Air Ride?
I don't know. But the next tier up, you would think, okay, it's going to be a little bit harder. It's mind-bendingly harder. And the game is just consistently conspiring to just screw you up. Like, somebody hits you, you spin out, you lose all your speed, suddenly you're in last place. If you hit them, you spin out, lose all your speed, you're suddenly in last place. The AI seems to have no concern for the stats of their tube sliders. So, a tube slider with a higher top speed than your tube slider will continuously just shoot past you at a relative speed that makes no sense. And you think, oh, they're boosting, but you're boosting. And so that's not it. So I don't know what's going on. I did manage to get third place in that one, which is really hard because you have to get fourth or better in all five races and you only get three continues. And then I went to the most difficult circuit of the easy, essentially, the normal difficulty. And you have to go through all five tracks you've already seen before you get to see the new tracks, which is frustrating. And I just couldn't do it. Like, it's brutal. Essentially, everybody in that is as hard as the best racer in the one above it. And so you've got seven racers who are as good as like first place was in the last tournament. It's just not fair. I've never seen a game with that kind of difficulty progression. I mean, it's a game that mechanically works okay, but that makes it unplayable. And while the game runs really well, I mean, it holds 60 constantly. It doesn't support 480p, which is probably part of the reason, and the game thing just hated it. But it also has this weird construct of, because you're in the tube, even when you're going over glass, or Lexan, or whatever futuristic clear material they've developed, your eyes are really, I mean, it's, you know, when you're driving fast, one of the risks is you develop tunnel vision. But when you're literally in a tunnel, and you're watching this guy right in front of you who seems impossibly able to keep the exact amount of distance he wants to keep between you and him, you really start to lock in. And no matter what they do around the stage, and a lot of it you're only seeing through the tube, you know, you're seeing through the clear parts of the tube, and that's kind of getting your what you're seeing. You're not watching that. You're just watching directly in front of you. You're watching that next turn. You're just kind of trying to hang on the turns because you are trying to maintain good position so you don't get forward speed as best you can. So visually, the game ends up being super boring as a result. If you think back to F-Zero GX, a lot of the visual artifacts, the things that they put in front of you to kind of give you a sense of place, were actually part of the course or would hang over the course conspicuously. Whereas in this, the course is 360 degrees, so all you're getting are things you're seeing supplemental. Everything that's not the course is just background. So as opposed to making you feel in place, it just feels like, oh, I'm driving through a tube of nothing. So there's a lot that's not right here. And the fact that this game was published by home electronics maker NEC after they hadn't published games forever, this was their, yeah, we should get back in that, and was developed by the Hudson refugees at partially owned Nintendo studio ND Cube before they got stuck on Mario Party duty forever. And that Nintendo didn't bother to tell them, hey guys, you probably shouldn't make this game. Even though they partially owned that company, there's so much weird about this game. Like, it's super Japanese, and yet the Japanese release got canceled. They're like, there's an NEC and NDQ are both Japanese companies. This game has weird legacy beyond its really just childishly innuendo used name.
This but is its legacy, I think.
It is.
This is the new business preview video. It's the legacy.
Yeah, the thing about the video that's most frustrating is all my reactions got time shifted because the audio sync got all screwed up. So like I'm sitting there going like, ah, damn it. And you can't see why I did it because it happened like a second or two earlier. But just know of all the ones I've done the new business preview on, this is the most frustrating in a lot of ways. That's really sad. It truly is the most depressing of these games we've played so far. But at the same time, like on a technical level, it does work. It's just there's so many problems that you go like, ugh, this kind of stinks.
So is that it for the Summer of Too Hot for Games? Is Mario Maker officially bringing that to an end next week?
We've got one more week before Mario Maker comes out, though, because Mario Maker comes out on Friday, I think?
Yeah, Friday the 11th.
Yeah.
Here in North America.
So the Summer of
Too Hot... You're going to spend that week doing that, but that is it. There's not going to be, like, too much foliage for games autumn season or whatever.
No. The summer of too many... the autumn of too many leaves.
Yes.
I'm not counting on it, but again, you know, if we have holes in the release schedule, I got to play something. Like, so at some point... You know, this is one of the things that being on the show, you learn is that you've got to play something because you have to talk about it.
If you don't buy and play Yoshi and instead buy Tube Slider 2 Electric Boogaloo or whatever,
if there was a Tube Slider 2, I would already have it, but I don't.
Yeah.
I've got a couple of GameCube games that I can go back to that, of course, Mario Maker will dominate our conversation for at least a couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean... I'm not counting on having to go back to the abyss, but I might go back to something that's, you know, I've got, speaking of treasure, I've got Wario World. I mean, that may come up. That may be a game.
It's all about treasure somehow. We just conspire into. I actually have a secret treasure game stashed away for discussion probably weeks from now.
And on that, I'm going to wrap up new business this week. We'll be back after the break with your listener mail. Now playing a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First up this week, we have a preview, Disney Infinity 3.0 on the Wii U by Don Cooten. If you're Disney, and we know you are here at RFN, especially Snow White and Cinderella, you want to check out Don's impression of the latest Disney Toys to Life masterpiece. Everything seems great, aside from the fact that the infinity in the title actually refers to the game's load times.
Heyo!
Ba-dum-tsh. We also have a review, Binding of Isaac Rebirth from 3DS eShop by Zach Miller. Of course Zach reviews this. Of course he does. Anyway, kids, there's now a second new 3DS XL exclusive game, and it's this one. Find out how this beloved, sick, and twisted title fares on 3DS. Just watch out for those hardware lockups, which are more nauseating than anything the game has to offer.
Yeah.
Only the finest port jobs out of Nicholas.
Yeah, pretty fantastic. All right, and we have a review of Hatsune Miku Project Mirai DX.
Nice.
On 3DS by Alex Kulafi. Of course Kulafi reviews this. Of course he does. I mean, it's right there in black and white. He likes Hatsune Miku because it features... quote unquote, anime teenagers being cute and having fun, which gives him, again, quote unquote, a nice warm feeling. This is also a rhythm game, so you know, draw your own conclusions and check out his review.
I don't like this.
Just wash your hands afterwards.
I don't like this.
And we also have an interview with JC Smith, Pokemon Company Marketing Director, also by Alex Kulafi. On a less unsettling note, Alex had a chance to interview the director of North American marketing for Pokemon.
Wait, well, less unsettling, but not totally unsettling.
Very true. Ever wonder how that brand is marketed? Curious about the planning of the Pokemon World Championships? Wonder how envious you should be of the guy who has the easiest marketing job ever? And he literally says that several times during the interview. Oh yeah, our job is really easy. We just throw some Pokemon out there and people love them. All this revealed in this wide-ranging interview.
All this and more half-assed efforts are available to you right now at NintendoWorldReport.com. We're back for listener mail. If you've got a question or comments, you can send it to RFN@NintendoWorldReport in a manner much similar to these people. First up this week, I'm going to have, Guy, you got the first email.
Sure. Mike writes, slowly but surely, the Nintendo Network is adding features that have long been available on rival services like PSN, such as cross-buy. Now Amazon is offering the ability to digitally purchase eShop credit and some titles on Wii U and 3DS. The Wii titles have long been there, although you had to really dig for them. What other initiatives do you expect to see Nintendo unveil for its network by year-end? Should we expect much prior to talk of NX gets going? I know there is something coming with its new mobile with this new mobile venture, but I wasn't sure how much of that was Japan exclusive. I'd love to hear your thoughts slash predictions. By the way, I absolutely love the new line the new lineup and the triumphant return of Greg. RFN is back to being my favorite podcast.
Real quick, I want to point out that means when Johnny wasn't here, it lost his status as favorite podcast.
I love the triumphant bit. It just makes me think of Tywin Lannister riding into the Red Keep and his horse doing a big shit in the throne room. That's my idea of triumphant.
you're certainly a bitter conquering hero who'll probably get killed by an arrow on the shitter.
Yep, that's how I want to go.
hey, he died like he lived.
Exactly.
Spoiler alert, sorry.
So thanks, John. So real quick, just to kind of recap the news in case you didn't pick up on what Mike was talking about. So this week it came, Amazon started selling essentially digital copies of Nintendo eShop games. So I want to say it's WiiWare, Wii U eShop, 3DS eShop. I believe that's accurate. And does it just auto-download? I think it does. If you buy it and you sync up your Wii U, your Nintendo Network account, and it just goes.
I think we should have researched that better.
I think we should
have. I do know. What I did learn was that you can't really buy... When you buy credits, you don't just get an email with a code to redeem the credits. You actually... They send them by mail. So you get actual cards that you scratch, etc.
That's weird.
So, yeah, maybe it's not the, you know, like the bright digital future that it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because they talked about this a long time ago in terms of doing these sorts of things with, you know, being able to buy games digitally from retailers and online retailers specifically. But it seems to have taken a lot longer to bear fruit in America than in some other places. I mean, I think, you know, I mean, over here we've had sort of digital purchases from the biggest dedicated gaming retailer, Game, since... Creatively named. Yeah, since I think probably the second half of 2013 or something like that. Yeah, where you could just buy a code, and then, you know, you just go to the eShop, go to redeem
We've had that, but I mean, I'm now on the page, and yeah, it does. So
it
buying
right
it here,
through.
Yeah, you just click redeem now, and it essentially does kind of like what that webpage I talked about on the show does,
right,
where you paste the code in.
Yeah.
But it looks like it just happens automatically.
Yeah, see, we don't have that yet, so yeah, that's something that they've got a bit further, which is nice because I mean the code is kind of cumbersome.
Right.
So, right. But there's also, like, you can go on Nintendo's own website and click a few links, and you're going to make your way through to the eShop section, and you can already kind of select games. Like, you can purchase them there, enter your credit card info there, and then you select download automatically on my Wii U or my 3DS, and next time you're going to turn that on, it's going to start downloading.
Yep. In fact, if they're in sleep mode, they'll download automatically.
Right.
So, yeah, they announced that about a year or two ago at this point. And so the Sony and Microsoft's consoles do the same thing through their web version of their stores. I'm trying to remember why Nintendo announced. I think they just talked about how they wanted to be able to sell their stuff through any access point you had or something. Like, you could buy it on your phone or on your computer.
Makes sense.
So really this is just sort of the next step of that, where they've let another retailer tie into that system.
Well, yeah,
they kind of do soft rollouts of a lot of this stuff.
Hoping for with when they sort of, you know, the big sort of inflection point is coming up is this successor to Club Nintendo account.
Right.
Like, I mean, we don't exactly know what it's going to be. You know, have they kind of overpromised with it or whatever? You know, if you kind of go along with some of the expectations for it, it's something that could be. So, because what we've had so far is kind of stuff on an ad hoc basis. I mean, Mike talks about cross-buy, but it's not your cross-buy the way that you get it on other services.
Right,
you know what I mean?
You get, essentially get a code.
Yeah, exactly. Like I said, it's all kind of ad hoc and it's a bit messy, and it's nice when people go the extra mile to make that possible. But, you know, an integrate an integrated account that's on all your Nintendo devices that you don't have to do any kind of work to, you know, extend that license, you know, is really what you're looking for.
Right, but they keep iterating on this stuff and they keep improving it. And sure, like, there's a lot of games where you need a code, or you get a code on the digital receipt. Like, if you bought Mario vs. Donkey Kong on the 3DS, then on your receipt, you get the code to enter on your Wii U to download the version of that game.
Yeah,
I think that's kind of on purpose. I think they want people to share that with other people. They want people to be able to give out their code away.
Yeah, to gift it rather than just like have it be tied to their account. Like,
exactly.
I mean, that is an idea. You know, I mean, I think that's valid.
You've got other cases where, you know, like last week I mentioned Whoa Dave, and that was automatic. That was just, oh, you already bought this on 3DS.
Right.
Well, just download it on your Wii U.
I couldn't think of any game that did that before Whoa Dave.
I think there's... Yeah, we'd have to research that as well.
But it's fairly uncommon.
Yeah, I mean, so with some, it's kind of like you just get a discount. You know, like in the eShop, it'll show up as a discount that it's free. But you would still have to go and kind of manually purchase it,
but,
as if you were purchasing it, but it just happens to be like for no money because it knows that you've already bought it.
Point being, it's case by case, so.
Yeah, that's the point.
I do remember Jules Watcham saying that he was talking, when the Zero Drifter came out on the Wii U, at first on Twitter, he was saying like, well, I'm sorry, I couldn't work out with Nintendo how to make the Wii U version free for 3DS owners. And then later that day, he was like, okay, it's all settled. Wii U, people who have the 3DS version, you can just download it on your Wii U.
Yeah, I'm guessing what happened was Nintendo has a way to do it. And we know they obviously have a way to do it in their system, which one thing tells us that there is a more unified system than we may give them credit for.
Well, they've been unifying it. You know, I mean, one of the weirdest things that happened with Club Nintendo over here just recently, right at the end, you know, we've been on this death march since January.
Well, we've been dead since June.
Right.
So.
It's actually the death march was completed months ago in America. But over here, just recently, they had this option like, oh, you could sign into Club Nintendo by signing into Nintendo Network. And I was like, well, why is this integrating now? It's about to go away. So I can only assume that's some sort of test ground for what's going to come next.
Yep.
They've been sort of working towards integrating these, but it has been on a case-by-case basis. And, you need it institutionalized, you know, across the board. Mm-hmm. And that's why, I mean, what Mike talks about, will it be, you know, will we hear much about it prior to NX? It's kind of interesting because it's then that you want it built in, baked into the cake, you know, things get better as systems will always get firmware upgrades and working out the kinks, and launches these days are usually some sort of adventure. I mean, I don't think can really reasonably expect that won't be the case, but to at least have a baseline there that has all this stuff kind of integrated and unified and neatened up that they can then go and, you know, tune up as it goes along.
It just seems like a lot of this stuff has just been kind of like consecutive proofs of concept. That's what it feels like. A lot of this stuff is kind of Frankenstein-y and sort of ad hoc, like you said, like you have to put it, they'll turn it on for a game. They have no ability to turn it on across the board. They have to flip the switch on a game at the developer's request.
I would imagine that at this point they could do cross-buy for any game. It's just...
Well, yeah, but they'd probably have to turn it on for literally every... Like, they would have to go and touch every single game to do it. They couldn't just turn a switch and say...
It's just like...
I guess it's that if the developer wants it, right?
But even in the case of Zia Drifter, it's like, well, he kind of wanted it, but then... You know, Jules couldn't just make it happen himself. You know, there had to be some kind of process of bringing it to Nintendo's attention.
I do wonder if he just talked to the wrong person.
Well, but that suggests that the infrastructure is not there, you know, like where you would want
it
to be.
You can't do it yourself, but Nintendo runs your shop page, so that's not super surprising. It's not like Steam where the curator of the game has control over their shop page.
Yeah, but you can't just check a checkbox and say make this cross-buy.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Nintendo controls all
that stuff. Nintendo and say, dude,
that's all on Nintendo's side. And that's partially, I would guess, because they don't want to see somebody just like race to the bottom and make Jet Tailfin 75 cents and just like, hey, today I put out all my games for like 30 cents.
They still will, with all this stuff, they'll still exercise, a certain level of control that may be a bit different from some other service providers. But you just hope they make it all more integrated and more streamlined so that they can do that, but without holding everything up or, encumbering the developers.
So on the point of sort of adding features, backfilling features onto other systems.
System-wide voice chat, maybe? No, I'm just kidding. We're not saying that before end of the year.
I was waiting for you to laugh. So, so you can actually think back to what they did with Miiverse, where they retroactively applied Miiverse to the 3DS.
Yeah,
so
they did.
They developed Miiverse for the Wii U, and then they went and they made a 3DS version of Miiverse they applied to it, and then they integrated it into games. Like, you could take screenshots. Games that existed prior to there being a Miiverse on the period. Like, just how they made it work. So they have successfully done this sort of, like, appendix transfer, where you don't need this because it's an appendix, but we're going to transfer it into the system anyway. But, speaking from somebody
who's... What a weird analogy. What the fuck?
It's fine. Deal with it. Deal with it.
just the sunglasses go on.
As somebody who's, worked in companies where we've got all these systems, but maybe they're all homegrown and they didn't necessarily grow up together. They, one got built, a new system got built later that does something similar, and they may need to talk, but they don't naturally talk just because they're different. Maybe they have different technology, they reside in different places, they have different data structures, stuff like that. It is a very long process to wrangle all these things together. And you really have the choice of, do I just blow it up and start over again? Do I just, level everything and just start from ground zero again? And the problem is, if you're running a company, you really can't do that. Like, you just can't just say, burn it all down, we're going to start from scratch. Because you've got to keep running that company. You've got customers you have to serve. But if you're trying to do it while keeping the systems that are you're integrating alive and not just doing a build and replace, you've got this weird situation where you're having to make systems do things they were never designed to do. And you're always going to have conflict there. You're always going to have systems straining against this new functionality that's been imposed on them.
Yeah, it's like upgrading the car engine while it's moving.
Yeah, and putting it in a new car at the same time.
Yeah. I'm thinking that hopefully with NX, they'll kind of do like a 2.0 of their entire network infrastructure and just use it as a completely new...
To that end, though, the first deliverable of the... God, I'm talking like work. The first deliverable of the DNA partnership is the account system, which they originally pegged as fall of this year.
Yeah, that's right. And that should be... I mean, provided we at least hear things about that, coming to the end of this year, like I said, Club Nintendo is just about to cough out his last breath here. That will give us some idea, I think, of where they're going with the new system, what might lie ahead with future hardware. But as you kind of suggested, it may also not be like, if it's just kind of
the most
for these current systems, it might be limited, so it might give us like a bit of a limited glimpse of the kind of tie-ins that you're going to get once you have these presumably NX is going to be all set up with this kind of account system that ties into mobile in mind.
The tricky part here is, we talk about they need a unified account system, but they have one. Like, they gained one with the Wii U, because the other thing that they brought back to 3DS really is...
Yeah, is the Nintendo Network ID. Like, that, right. That is something that they brought over. But, what you don't have is a feature, again, like you said, kind of feels like the 3DS is doing things it wasn't particularly designed to do, and the Sharp and all that.
Absolutely.
It's not, they've linked them in, and you've got something, you have a unified wallet and all that kind of stuff, and they can do the cross-buy stuff to the extent that they can, but it's not the same. And so that's in terms of stuff that's going to be up until the end of this year. I can't see it being anything that, it probably could be more ad hoc kind of little things to help kind of in the build up to the bigger, more hopefully more fundamental kind of launch of an account system and a digital platform that'll exist for the next hardware, NX, whenever that is going to come along.
And just to give some kind of insight into the kinds of, you know, I know this is like what features think are coming, and I'm going to get to that in a second, but to kind of give some insight into the sort of discussions that happen when you do these kinds of just, you know, ground level changes to how your systems work. So people who bought a Wii U registered Nintendo Network accounts. You had to. You had to register a Nintendo Network account. And let's say they're just going to burn it all to the ground and develop a new DNA system. Well, even if they find a way to migrate your friends list to the new system, are they really going to force you to register a new login, potentially lose the login that you got for yourself? If you somehow manage to register effing Mario, like, are they going to make you lose Mario? Well, no. So there's a customer service issue there. Like, there's a lot of these really complicated questions that they need to solve that are not just technical. There's, like, a certain usability question in play that makes me shocked that when they announced it early this year and said, by late this year, we're going to have it. I thought, are you mad? There's no way. So I don't know if this is all just going to be built on top of the Nintendo Network, which you could probably do. But... Yeah, there's some weird challenges that they've got to solve that I kind of don't see them adding new features, which is where I was going with this, because of all of the complex things they have to work through to make all this work.
And for what? It's not really worth it at this point.
It is only insofar as you find ways to make money. So the Amazon thing makes sense because it is a mechanism through which they can generate money.
Yes.
And of course, Nintendo has this curious history with Amazon in the States, doesn't it? About them not selling their hardware and all this. So it's kind of interesting that they've managed to come to an accord here.
Yeah, and you know, I don't know that they're gonna. I mean, you guys can go around. I don't know if they're gonna add anything for the time being. What are you thinking?
No, I'm not convinced we'll add anything. But maybe, you know, if they start at least, you know, showing the new loyalty program and, you know, the sort of account that's going to be linked to, it might give us an idea of where it will go in the future and possibly on subsequent hardware. But I don't know how much it'll mean in the near term.
I think that Nintendo itself is probably very eager to show its rewards program, because just seeing the way that they're offering to mail people Super Mario Maker booklet, then you have to call them by phone. If you got the digital version, you have to tell them a code. That's so cumbersome, and I'm sure that people in Nintendo are just like, okay, we're working on this thing. I'm really looking forward to unveiling it, because then we won't have to do things like that.
Right, because in Smash they were able to handle it inside the Club Nintendo system.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
but now that doesn't exist anymore. God, that's unfortunate
timing, actually. Yeah. Think about it.
How did they? I mean, I imagine they brought down Club Nintendo when they did, because they had to bring it down in order to build the integrations they wanted to build. Like, they just couldn't leave it up, because otherwise, I could see them just leaving it up and just letting it sort of burn out the clock. So my guess is that it had to come down, and they probably weren't super thrilled about it either.
Yeah, or they just wanted to move staff over from that would be maintaining it. They were just like, we got to get these people moved over to test it or whatever.
All right, next email is John.
Kevin writes, "Hey guys, love the show. I've never been a huge fan of RPGs, but I'm currently looking for the right game to bring me in. Last year I played Mario and Luigi Dream Team, and while I enjoyed some aspects of the game, I lost interest about halfway through. Is there an entry-level RPG that you can recommend for someone who does not have a lot of experience in the genre? What about Fire Emblem Awakening or Fantasy Life? Thanks, and keep up the good work."
We were talking about this just before recording the segment. The thing is, like, I think that almost all of us, who like RPGs got started with them back when they kind of sucked. You know, like, back when there were growing pains, or back when they were not as, user friendly as they could have been. You know, Dragon Quest is very, well, Dragon Warrior back then was pretty cumbersome, and, They smoothed out some things for the North American version, but still, it's not exactly. I don't think
that game in particular.
Yeah, but even like the first Final Fantasy, you know, there's a lot of things that would bug a RPG player today, you know, if they were to go back to it. So my advice in general would be to look at newer RPGs and not try to go back to the roots, because the roots are, you know, hard to go back to.
Yeah. They've made things a lot more playable.
Well, mm-hmm. I mean, for me, my first exposure to RPGs was in the 16-bit era, so there'd been a fair bit of refinement at that point.
Yeah.
Chrono Trigger, I think, is an obvious but still absolutely worthwhile title to recommend in this area, because I think it's not too long mm-hmm. for a start. You know, I mean, that's something that's put me off certain RPGs, finishing them. But Chrono Trigger's a nice length. Good pacing, you know, compared to some other RPGs. It's got, you know, it's not that difficult. It's not like that complex or arcane in its systems. It's got some nice kind of intuitive user-friendly kind of things about the fact that you can see the enemies and avoid them to some extent and all that. I mean, and of course, it is just a very beautiful game, incredible soundtrack, and all the great
things. It's also fairly lighthearted too, so it's not
yeah,
very
it's
somber
not, it's not,
in mood.
It's not too heavy. It's not too kind of like caught up in like doing lore or, you know, like really it kind of going deep dive into stuff where it's not connected to another series that you have to like be, you know things about or anything. It's a good adventure yarn.
And I
think anybody could get into that.
Yeah, you talked about the pacing. I think that's the thing. It doesn't feel padded, and also it always feels like what you're doing matters. You know, there's always a reason behind it. You know, you start out, there's some time travel hijinks, and then you're sent back to, you're sent to the future, and you realize, oh, wait, maybe there's a purpose to us being here, or maybe, like, we can prevent something using this time travel that we can do. I think it's a really intelligently put together RPG, and it's one of... I don't think I can name many RPGs that have so little padding.
It just feels like, I mean, there's optional stuff, you know, if you really get into it, you know, there's a lot of other stuff you can do with it too. It'll end up taking up a lot of your time if you want to see a lot of the different endings, if you want to get all the best gear in the side quests and all that. But in general, it's got a great sense of direction about it with the narrative. I think does a good job of just keep feeling like you're going different places, but at the same time you're on point. So I think that's tough to top. I would say if you're gonna go Mario & Luigi, the original Superstar Saga, which is on Wii U Virtual Console now, is the best choice probably as the entry point, because that is probably the best paced of the lot. Certainly much better paced than Dream Team. And so he does say that he enjoyed some aspects of the game. Obviously, I'm not sure, you know, which aspects those were, but you know, I think the amount of dialogue and the kind of more flabby nature of that game could have been a bit off-putting for Kevin. So if that's the case, Superstar Saga wouldn't be a bad idea.
Yeah, I think that the Mario and Luigi franchise in general has gotten more and more verbose and more hand-holdy.
I think Bowser's Inside Story was the better than the games on either side of it. It's not just a straight line. But Superstar Saga would probably remain the best to start with. I think
so.
It's very good.
So first off, I want to say I'm upset that Guillaume can't think of a game that's got less padding than Chrono Cross. I mean, see, Chrono Trigger, because Chrono Cross has 45 characters and none of them are padding. So I don't know.
shut up.
I don't know what you're talking about. And each of them has their own series of quests, so there's no padding in that game whatsoever.
That's another PlayStation RPG I made it 15 hours in and then just...
So you made it to the first boss. That game is so long.
And
even the final boss battle has padding. It's unbelievable.
I do plan on revisiting it, but
that game
I don't
is
know.
Amazing.
We'll see.
I love that game, but I'll make fun of it all day long.
Suikoden, if you've got a PSP or PlayStation 3, I think that the first one is 20 hours long, and it's very good pace, and battles are fast, and it's a good story.
I'm actually going to another Square franchise. I'm actually going specifically with Secret of Mana.
That was my first one.
Yeah.
Which it does a bunch of things. One, it's got in-world combat, essentially, and it's real-time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it's got puzzle solving, overworld puzzle solving. So a little bit, if you like some Zelda stuff, it's a little bit in there. I mean, it's got item use and stuff to try to solve puzzles. You can play multiplayer if you've got somebody else to play with. There's stuff here that makes that game a little bit more palatable. It's kind of a halfway point into being a JRPG of the era versus being an action game of the era. Yeah. It can kind of help you get there a little bit. I did get real damn tired of killing rabbits at some point.
Yeah,
because you kind of kill a lot.
We actually did a retroactive, one of the earliest retroactive Secret Mana. So if for any reason Kevin or anyone else wants to hear us talk about it more in depth, you could go back to that. However many hundreds of episodes ago,
how many rabbits have you killed? Thousands.
They are good at, you know, repopulating, aren't they? That's the problem.
I killed a yellow rabbit today. What's happening? That game is one of the worst examples of just sprite recolors I can think of.
Exquisite music on that one as well.
Oh yeah, like there is so much about that game that works out really well, and it's on the Virtual Console, which is helpful.
Yeah, on the Wii mm-hmm. Virtual Console.
The Wii Virtual Console.
Which Chrono Trigger is too on the Wii Virtual Console. Those are not. I think maybe Secret Mana's on the Wii U Virtual Console in Japan, but not elsewhere.
I don't think so. I know.
Some of the Square games are. Not all of them are in Japan, but not elsewhere.
I know. There's an iOS and Android port, which I'm sure is terrible. Like, I'm sure it is abysmally bad.
Because the more actiony it is, the worse it gets, sure.
Yeah, I would strongly advise going nowhere near those versions, because I'm sure they are terrible. And Square's ports have not been great with mobile, and this one is probably going to be particularly onerous.
Yeah. I'd say Super Mario RPG to a degree. I don't think it's aged as well, but man, I love that game. That's the game that I abandoned Chrono Trigger for. So I rented.
We've been going on about the fact that Chrono Trigger is super snappy, but it took John
the thing though. This was actually a turning point in gaming history for me, because on the same weekend, and I've brought this up before, I rented both Chrono Trigger and Super Mario RPG, and I started playing Super Mario RPG first, and so that just. I mean, that took the weekend out, and Chrono Trigger was just pushed to the wayside. But I really like Super Mario RPG. It's a good mix of kind of that sort of party-based combat, but also action as well. And, of course, leading on to that, Paper Mario as well for N64. It's a little bit more action-y, a little more platformer.
Yeah, it's even more gentle in terms of the RPG elements, isn't it? It kind of more reduced down. And I think that's probably not as well paced as Superstar Saga, for instance, but a viable option.
Yep.
Yeah, and I think that in these cases, like it does, it's weird. Like my general advice about like going with newer games doesn't always apply, especially for Mario RPGs, because they seem to get longer and they kind of lose their way a bit. So I do think you're better off with the first Mario and Luigi, with Super Mario RPG, with the first Paper Mario. But if, like, at some point, if you play those and you enjoy them and you want to get into, other RPGs, like, from other companies, if at some point you want to try something like Etrian Odyssey, go with the newer ones, because they actually get better and more approachable as entry after entry.
Yeah,
like, Etrian Odyssey Untold 2 is the most approachable of them all so far.
But yeah, they've just been getting more and more kind of features, haven't they? Always like the story's optional, and then there's all these other things that are optional. They're kind of bringing it, and it's like you're mapping it yourself there. So it's got kind of an old school kind of element to the exploration, but it's got a lot more modern sort of usability things added onto it at this point in series life.
I mean, depending what you like outside of RPGs, like there
well,
is...
that's what I was going to raise that, because he does say, like, what about Fire Emblem Awakening or Fantasy Life? Now, that's a pretty big range.
So,
there.
Fantasy Life is boring.
Very, very different. Yeah.
If you have insomnia, yes, get Fantasy Life. You
Fantasy
will
Life
sleep
is,
like
to
a
the
baby.
Point
of
if you like to grind professions. From what I understand, that's Fantasy Life, effectively.
If you come home from work and say, man, I wish work was all day long.
No.
But the point being that with Fire Emblem being a strategy or a tactical RPG, whatever the proper term was, it obviously it's very much like Advance Wars in many respects. So, Fantasy Life is nothing like Advance Wars and most of the RPGs we've talked about.
Yeah, it's a very different type of game.
That's the thing. I mean, apart from like how accessible they are in terms of, are they more for the core audience that enjoys those games? How much they depend on kind of your knowledge of the genre or whatever? Just the kind of game varies dramatically across what we term RPG.
Yeah, well, is it an RPG or is it just a different genre with RPG elements? Because right. a lot of stuff has RPG elements now.
So like, I'll give you a good example of a game that I think is an RPG, but you could argue that it's not. Why did I suddenly blank on the name of the game? Valkyria Chronicles. So, to me, Valkyria Chronicles is an RPG from the mechanics of how it tells its really dumb story, how it sort of constructs its world, and how its characters sort of evolve. But at the same time, you could argue very cleanly that it's not an RPG because there's no character individual stat development. You're just sort of leveling up the gear that... You can hand out gear, but you can do that on a lot of games, and you assign, essentially boost stats on a class level. You're saying, all of my foot soldiers are now, you know, all my scouts are now leveled up, all of my heavies are now leveled up. So to that argument, you could say it's not an RPG, you're just essentially making your base classes stronger, and that the main gameplay is strategy. But there's certainly an RPG style to that game. It sort of wraps itself in RPG trappings, even though it itself doesn't really have a lot of the hallmarks of what makes an RPG an RPG. Trying to think of what kind of one that would like. I'll give a good example. I was given level 5 of the business earlier, but like, let's say you really enjoy soccer, like unironically enjoy that game.
That's Inazuma 11 references.
Inazuma 11 is actually kind of...
Can we handle this?
It's not very long. Like, you could beat it in about 10, 12 hours. It's a dumb, silly game that's funny in its own right.
No.
I mean, it is.
No. I say, like, if...
You're the only person I've talked to who doesn't think that game is
funny. I'd recommend Tube Slide.
Look, if Kevin doesn't... Like, if Kevin lost kind of interest in Mario and Luigi Dream Team, like, if he doesn't have really... If you can't really stand like BS, like people talking,
don't know it's those specific.
Right. We don't know
no, but I mean, like, there's a lot of anime bullshit in it, and there's a lot of conversations that should be cut. You know, the game needs
that's
editing.
Your opinion. That's your opinion.
Yeah,
that's,
it is.
That's like your opinion, man. I think you're wrong.
It is factually correct that that's Guillaume's opinion.
I mean, one thing I would say is that Fire Emblem Awakening, I have no idea whether he's played Advance Wars or, you know, those sorts of games, you know, but I mean, the one thing you can say about Awakening is sort of similar to what Guillaume was saying with the Etrian Odyssey games. It's bringing in a lot of conveniences that like previous ones, installments of the series didn't have. You do have the casual mode or whatever it's called, you know, where you don't have permanent death of the characters.
Well, and that was in the last DS game, but that game is also terrible.
Yeah,
so,
whereas, you know, I mean, Awakening is very highly acclaimed, and, you know, I mean, you can play it in a bunch of different ways, so maybe, you know, that could be a good option, I think, because it does make some nice accommodations for new kinds of players. I think if it hadn't, it wouldn't have sold as well as it did. You know, it kind of bucked the trend with sales for the franchise.
Yeah, but, and it rebooted the franchise so much that Nintendo's going all in now.
Yeah, oh yeah, this like, yeah, Fates is
essentially 3DS, 3DS
three games.
Games,
yeah, like 3 games with the console,
and then a spin-off.
If I had to pick a level 5 game, I would go Dragon Quest IX, because it's just, you know, classic formula, except that it's the first one in the series where you can actually see the enemies on the screen. So no random battles, and it's straightforward, and it actually explains its mechanics well. You don't lose for no reason, unlike other games, which may or may not involve soccer.
But again, it depends what you... Hey, I played Inazuma 11 and didn't lose once.
You lost. That's untrue, because there are matches you lost because the game wanted you to lose them and didn't tell you that. So,
well, that doesn't count.
And you lost my
story.
It sure counts when the game tells you, yeah, like try to win and then won't allow you and like doesn't explain what's going on. I think that's just frustrating. I don't think that's a good entry level RPG at all.
The Ridley scene at the start of Super Metroid is total shit.
Yes, this is a game targeted originally towards 6-year-olds. Obviously, 6-year-olds have too much skill for Guillaume, so I'll let it go. Well, here's what I'll say. Here's what I will say, though.
6-year-olds are idiots.
Before we wrap this up, and it tears the show to pieces.
Yeah,
it's
become quite contentious, more so than I thought it would be.
I'm glad you agree, John. You know, it's the idea of the RPG elements that John brought up. Like, maybe that's how you get in, you know? Something like the Game Boy Color Mario Tennis.
Black Ops 3.
Yeah, mm-hmm. The Black Ops 3, yes. The fantastic JRPG Black Ops 3.
We didn't specifically say JRPG.
I know.
I mean, I know we've gone in that direction because you have Dream Team.
The thing is, a lot of Western RPGs don't feel as approachable. Like, they feel like we're going to do... Because they go way higher on the customized
side. Well, they have more of a sort of PC background, and that all tends to go into more, you know, like, you know...
Towards like D&D stuff.
I mean the quintessential Japanese RPG is Dragon Quest, which was successful because of how accessible it was, and then, you know, Pokemon is built on that and all that kind of stuff. So I mean,
did we not say Pokemon?
Well, the thing about
that's
Pokemon,
not my place to say Pokemon. It's
the
yours.
The thing about Pokemon games is
Diamond and Pearl. What are you talking about?
Yeah, Pokemon's kind of its own thing, though. I mean, I don't know. I mean, yes, they're RPGs, but I mean, man.
It must be fairly accessible because of just the number of kids that continue to get indoctrinated into it all the time. But from an outside point of view, it might not seem the most inviting because there's all this kind of huge roster of monsters and the types and how they play against each other and all that that already exists. And so sometimes you wonder whether people might get put off. But when you actually play it, you know, the way that leads you through the story and all that, I mean, it's not daunting.
That's why you have essentially all the gym leaders are type-based. So you learn what types to take into that gym and deal with them.
It's the same thing, though. I mean, I would say if you're going to play Pokemon, play the newer games. Because they have a lot of...
The 3DS ones, essentially.
Yeah. Play those ones because they're much better than the really old ones.
All right. Well, if anybody doesn't have anything else, I guess we'll go on to the next email. Greg.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Adolf Vega writes, on a recent episode of RFN, you guys briefly mentioned aspects of gaming journalism, and James said reporting all gaming information is the job of any journalist. So regarding game journalism, I have a few questions. Firstly, how do you define news? Obviously, if Nintendo announces a new Wario game via press release, interesting choice of franchise there, that is news and it is worthy of posting. However, if Nintendo sends out a press release that only mentions new Wario game releasing today and buy it today, that isn't news, it's just a PR release.
So, in order to do, because, I mean, John, you were site director and I was a senior editor on the site, so we both have dealt with this.
By the way, I want to say right now, this question is get your Admiral Akbar GIFs ready. It is a trap.
Yeah, it is.
Because if you remember, Carl and Stan did the pirate radio thing and talked about game journalism, and it was all the crap that they came out with that got Johnny to have to come on and do his corrections thing the first time that he did that.
Before we cast the ultimate corrections.
And then, you know, that kind of was part of the process of getting him to be a fixture on the show. I think this is a diabolical plot on the part of Adolf Vega. With a sinister name like that, it's no surprise that he is trying to get Johnny to come back on the show because we are going to answer this question so badly that he will have no choice.
So actually, you know what? I short-circuited that because John and I have both been editors on the site.
We're seasoned gamers.
John was the site director, so... So there's that, and John was a fantastic placeholder site director.
That was a great figurehead.
Steward of Gondor, John.
So, but in anticipation of this, I reached out to Donald and Neil, Donald being our current news director, our editor, and Neil being, of course, site director for quite a while now, and I sent them this email to get their take on it, so to supplement our experiences discussing news, and not just what we would want, what we would do, but what we would want to see from our peers. So I do want to put some context around the comment about it's your responsibility to report this stuff, because what I was saying was if you are told something, if you have something, and you know, even if you realize that in that case it was about the interview that blanking on his name now did for the about you know talked
the
about
Pranger.
It's your responsibility as a journalist to go out there with what you know. So in that case, because he didn't retract what he was saying, or he didn't go, hey guys, actually let's not talk about that. They now had information that, you know, the contract they have with their audience is we're going to get information for you. We're going to track down the news. And they now had it. So for them to have just gone, oh, I can't. What I was saying was there was a certain blowback against that outlet saying, well, they should have just held that. They should have known it was going to get them in trouble. No, but that's not their job.
They were not told that it was off the record. I mean, at that point, if you want it off the record, say it's off the record.
Right. And you can do that retroactively if you're an interviewee. And if you're an interviewer, you should honor that. If somebody comes up and goes, hey, I shouldn't have said that. Please don't post that. Like, that's fine. I mean, you don't have to honor it at that point. You can be a total dick, but you should. But if they don't, then you're good to go. Like, you now have a certain moral obligation to your audience to provide them that information. To what is journalism and what isn't journalism? Reposting press releases is not journalism.
No.
Journalism, as it is defined, is the collection of and, you know, servicing of information. So just reposting somebody's press release doesn't
I don't even know if doing game reviews is journalism.
It's not.
Because you can post reviews of something on Consumer Reports and no one considers you a journalist.
Right, it's not. But editorializing isn't journalism either. Editorializing is editorializing. That's why newspapers keep those departments very separate. They are doing different things, and they're not journalists, they're editorialists. But to the question of what is journalism? I do want to quote Neil here because I thought this was particularly important here. He goes, his guiding point was as something. He defined news as something our readers or staff give a crap about. Like, that is a direct quote. He said that's his guiding principle. He says, to that point, the readers may care that Sin and Punishment is out on the virtual console, so that release announcement is news. But writing a whole story about... But it's not worthwhile to write a whole story about Just Dance coming to the stores today. And if you go back on Nintendo World Report, Planet GameCube, Planet N2000's history, there were stories like, hey, this game's out today. But ultimately, we've moved away from that because it's not... It doesn't provide anything meaningful to you. We have on the side of our page, we have the games coming out today. Now, if that game gets a release date, that's a different thing. Then maybe you write a story about that because it is news.
The thing is, like, we're in the enthusiast sphere, right?
Emphasis on ass.
But yeah, so we're, you know, like, even as we're doing news, we're kind of doing PR as well. Like,
to a certain extent.
Kind of how it is. I mean, like, we're not doing public relations for these companies. They've got their public relations. Yeah. But we're not selling their stuff either. But we are playing their game.
Any type of media that covers a specific industry runs into this problem.
Yeah.
To a certain extent, you have to sort of take what they give you because they're the source of the news. Nintendo's not just going to put games out and not tell us about them and then like, guys, I discovered this game on the store shelves. I don't know what it is. It's about a game where you race and you control robots. Except they did kind of do that for ExciteBots. But that's why I use this example. But in general, that's not how it goes. So it's not like you can do investigative journalism on just the brass tacks of products. Where you would do investigative journalism is really going to do research into the process, into what's going on behind the scenes, or into another one of his questions about trying to investigate rumors. So trying to find...
Tough if you don't have sources.
Yeah, so he asked, you know, how do you handle unofficial information? Rumors are endless and insidious. You know, when do you post rumors? And how do you know when it's bullshit you don't, quote, have time to publish it? And, you know, we get emails about this every so often. Of course, we follow gaming news sites. You know, stuff breaks on websites, Twitter, gaming sites, your Chan sites. This is where a lot of the stuff comes out. So... How do you handle it? How do you try to figure out what's real and what's not real? And Donald had an interesting point here. He says, you know, we tend to reach out to people we know to see if there's any fire to go along with smoke. The biggest example recently was the drama regarding Devil's Third. Our original source had been credible in the past, so we ran the story about Nintendo not publishing it. When the flip-flop happened, we got words from our sources that Nintendo reversed course and decided to onboard publishing it themselves, so we ran that. If we can trust... And verify to a certain extent, obviously. We can't 100% verify the news, verify a rumor. But if we have trust in the sources that we've got and we have sources that we think can back it up and it makes sense, then we'll run it as a rumor. But we always mark our rumor articles as rumors. Like, that is vital. Do not report rumors as news. You should clearly delineate them as rumors. And you should also, there's also a certain art to writing a rumors piece. you don't write it the same way as news. Because news, you know, you have to follow this, get the facts out right away in a news story. You want to get the important facts in there. For a rumor, you do always have to provide some context behind the rumor. Because ultimately, that's the information that we're using to make the determination if we feel like this rumor has substance. And, you know, as I said, the journalist's role is to get the information in the hands of our audience. So to that extent, we should provide them the same information that we use during our critical thinking process to determine if we think this rumor is trustworthy. And that means, you know, maybe we can't say, hey, we talked to this guy. He told us everything there is to know. Obviously, we can't do that. But we would give context like, you know, we spoke to sources who confirmed this for us as well. Or, you know, we have to give at least some context to the reader.
Well, yeah. And I mean, also, this some of it bears itself out over time, right? You have a track record. Like, we've talked to a well-placed source. And, you know, people kind of see that and recognize it. Like, you know, if... over time, if these things kind of turn out to be true, then they start to trust your sources. You know, you kind of build up that rapport.
What are the examples that he puts out there? Is just like sourcing something from Reddit where a Toys R Us employee says they'll Bowser Jr. will get 4,000 amiibo. You know, is that news? Is that a rumor?
That's nothing.
It's literally nothing because you have essentially an unverifiable source providing questionable information that when you really put critical thinking behind it, would an average Toys R Us employee know how many friggin' Bowser Juniors they're gonna get? It's always better to pass on a rumor and ultimately it proved to be true than run with a rumor that is false. Yep. Because that hurts your credibility. Another question he asks about is etiquette. You know, how do you interact with people over email, you know, PR, game dev, stuff like that. And, you know, Neil says the best way to start a relationship with developer PR is outside of the review coverage. You know, get on mailing lists, reach out to the PR contacts, because all of the games, pretty much every game that comes out now, unless you're dealing with like the real dregs of the Wii U eShop, has a PR contact. Even indie games like Runbow have PR contacts. Like they have somebody you can reach out to whose job it is to get you on a mailing list so they can send you info about it. Ask, you know, when you get that information, ask good questions. Really engage with that PR rep. You know, don't just take their press release, go, okay, I'm going to turn this into a preview. Like, sit there, really do analysis. Watch all the media that's out there on this thing and try to come up with questions and really, you know, start a relationship with the PR rep. Don't just go in there like, can I have a review copy now? I've got X many readers. Like, really, you know, start building that bridge. And eventually you'll get to the point where they've got a product they're trying to get out there and you're on their mailing list and they're used to talking to you. And that's when you're in a better position to start to maybe ask, hey, can I get a review copy for that? I want to talk about it. I want to cover it. But, you know, you don't just go out there, just go like, hey, I just started a website, review copies, please.
Yeah, and a lot of people do that.
And they get a lot of that. And also it depends on the company. It is hard as hell to get stuff from Nintendo. It's really difficult. Infamously, we couldn't get shit out of Nintendo of Europe forever. I mean, Greg can testify to this. Like, it was impossible.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, no, they
told us where to stick it. So, yeah, I mean, that happens too. Like, that's something you need to be ready for in email etiquette. You know, always be professional. Always be asking good questions. Always be trying to work with but not work for these PR contacts. So Neil actually mentions that, you know, when you establish that pre-existing relationship, that's when you can start maybe asking for codes. And he also mentioned that, you know, if you want to get review codes for Nintendo, raw honesty here, and this is an exact quote, be a YouTuber if you want Nintendo review codes. Nintendo's putting a major focus there. You know, he said a few smaller sites get stuff from Nintendo, but they mostly just get the small stuff. They didn't get Mario Maker, but they got LBX was the example he mentioned. You know, we've been at this for 15 plus years, and we still have issues getting review copies promptly and on time. Like, Nintendo is not... They don't need you. Like, I'm not saying that dismissively, but they don't. Like, that's... Yeah.
They really look for reach and they look for eyeballs, and wherever that is, they don't really care necessarily. They don't really care what you've done for them in the past.
Right. Like, so RFN has a decent listener base. We don't ask for review copies because we know we're not going
to
get them.
Well, that's the thing. Now, to Neil's point, if we did suddenly bump up our, you know, YouTube releasing, then...
Yeah, maybe that pushes things. So Don, I'm sure Don does pretty well in getting review copies.
Absolutely.
I know he gets them on for eShop stuff, even though he murders some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. He would still get it because you know,
he has
bad
good reach.
Coverage is better than no coverage at all.
He has very good reach in terms of his subscribers.
Like, he has what, like 40,000 subscribers or something crazy
and
like
he
that? That's really, really
good. He is constantly putting out content, so people expect content from him. And you know, you're getting in front of eyes, and that's what matters. So I guess one or two quickies then. You know, is it lazy to just copy and paste press releases, or should you clean them up? You shouldn't clean them up. You should post them as they were, unless they just completely screw up on your site.
I think it goes to what is the function of gaming media, you know? Like, whether you call it journalism media, whatever you want to call it, what are you doing for your readers? And I think in this age in particular, of the fact there's all this information out there and all that, I think what James talks about, analysis, critical thinking, substantiation with sources, all that, it's kind of a filtration system, you know, for people that don't necessarily have all the time in the world to invest in reading all the message boards and like living and breathing every rumor and all that.
Right.
It's something to make all the information that's out there digestible in the way that's like, okay, this is worth my time to look at, and I can quickly kind of assimilate all that information and feel like I've got something that, you know, to go back to Neil's definition, I give a crap about, you know, quickly. And without much fuss, like those are the sort of functions that good gaming media to me provide.
And then I guess the one last one is he asked for tips on transcribing audio interviews. I was gonna say Donald put it in there. Listen to it a bunch of times, like listen to it multiple times, and that's really, you know, how you get out of there. That's all there is to it. I mean, I agree. I did one during E3. Just listen a bunch of times. Listen to it once and don't transcribe anything. That kind of stuff. And I would say that doing interviews, like from a tip from doing interviews, do freaking research before you do the interview. That's hard at E3 when you don't know what the hell you're going to be talking about. So if they, you know, we had a Chibi Robo Ziplash interview. That game didn't exist as far as we knew 24 hours beforehand, but do prep. Like, just be ready, have questions ready, be ready to go, and just, you know, understand what the parameters of the interview is. Don't walk into the Chibi Robo Ziplash interview and ask a bunch of questions about Federation Force. You can ask, hey, can we talk about Federation Force? Which we did, and they're gonna tell you no. So then don't bring it up again. Like, just let it go. Anything else?
No, money hats. That's all I gotta say.
Oh yeah, that too. Take the money.
Money talks, baby.
Take the money.
You want an 8.5? Let's talk.
Take the money.
But I'm thinking of a color, and that color is green.
That's going to do it for Listener Mail this week. We had stuff we didn't have a chance to get to. We always do. We've got lots of email, but we want more. We want your email. Give us your email. Send your questions, comments, concerns, marital concerns, suggestions for music at the end of the show, suggestions for our retroactive poll, which is going to go up very soon, which is Mario games that you can get. I know I said in the notes on the eShop, preferable eShop, but if you can get it cheap online, we'll consider it too. Games featuring Mario that are not in Mario Maker. A lot of our suggestions have hewed towards platformers. I'm going to suggest you think outside the box. Just from
we've got Ali.
Why don't you tell them what to vote for, James? Because that's where you're going with this.
No, I'm just saying. I'm just telling. Here's the thing. We've gotten a lot of suggestions for platformers, but we're really open to anything Mario is in at all. So
we got alleyway. James.
We did get alleyway. We did get alleyway. You're right. Just think broadly. Think broadly. Do you want Mario is in Yoshi Cookie? He's in there. He's in that game. I don't know if Yoshi Cookie is available in the eShop, but he's in there.
It is.
So there, actually, I don't know if he's in there or not.
No, he is.
Okay, yeah. But like. Broad spectrum here. Is Mario in the game? Checkbox, you're good to go. So, just keep that in mind. So you could send all those, your suggestions, your questions, your comments, your Mario's, your end music to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. That's rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Say it twice. It's a trick from commercials where they say the phone number two times because it helps you remember it. We also have... Actually, I wanted to go ahead and go do another round of Twitter plugs because we haven't done them in a while. Of course, you can go to the official RFN Twitter account, which is @RFNPodcast, all one word. It is primarily manned by our Mr. John Lindemann. John, what is your Twitter account?
My Twitter account is Mr. Diamond J, MRDIA, MOND, letter J.
The letter J. Guillaume?
My Twitter account is GuillaumeNWR, and just look it up.
Just look it up. That's the problem. We're trying to give them tools to look it up. Greg, besides the unofficial Twitter accounts, nothing?
No, it's not happening.
Good. Good. I'm going to ask every time we do this, though, just to make you say no.
Oh, for God's sake. Profoundly tedious. Good Lord.
People want to reach you, Greg.
I'm blathering on this thing every week again.
They want to reach through the tubes and slide to your heart. So, and I am NWR_James, which is where you can follow for all kinds of tube slider, just immaturity. And also we have the Facebook page that John lovingly updates every week.
Ignore it every week.
With the new show
announcement. I ignore it with utmost care.
Where you can reach out to John and get all kinds of questions answered because he's prowling that page every day. And of course, we haven't done this one in a while. Please rate us on iTunes. If you subscribe on iTunes, obviously. Because that's how we find new listeners. And you know, if you've got people you think might be interested in the show, you can tell them about it, please. We're, you know, it's always good for us to try to build out our audience and try to get people listening because that's ultimately the lifeblood of the show. Your emails and our interaction with you is what makes the show A, worth doing, and B, possible. And on that, we're going to wrap up the show. We've got some music suggestions from John this week. We went round robin, so everybody on the show has put in a suggestion. John has picked the always appropriate ending theme to John.
Lords of Thunder.
Good night, everybody.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Later.
Sticker fodder.
Is it really appropriate if we didn't do a Thunder Round?
It's the always appropriate
Lords
of Thunder.
It's in lieu of the Thunder Round.
It could have been more appropriate is what I'm saying.
Maybe.
It's a swerve, man.
It's all... But
you know?
Yeah. On the
doing what's not expected of us.
Exactly.
On the appropriateness scale...
It's entertainment, Guillaume.
It may not be 130%, but it's always 100%.
I see.
Yeah, so I mean, there's good stuff in there. I mean, we never really properly did Odama. We did it during 400, but as we found that John and I are truly the masters of strategy, whereas Johnny and Guillaume just just hadn't studied the tactics of, you know.
I think you guys played more than we had.
Ancient like,
you,
Chinese
you
warfare.
Observed us. You observed us, and then you learned from our mistakes, and then you went on to Adama greatness.
Hold on, pause.
Well, I think it's more to do with the fact that you've never read The Art of War.
Yeah, I mean, I actually, I
you can
I
Sony
I
and Microsoft
point,
yourself out, and we'll just come in.
Yeah,
and sweep
I want to point out though that you made a fatal mistake in that calculation, Guillaume. You assumed that John Lindemann and I are capable of learning. And that history has proven
yes,
is not the case.
Well, I'm up for like an Odama retroactive. I bought the game
oh,
after
man, that
our
would be,
misadventures.
That would be freaking amazing.
But you have to cut the microphone.
Because nobody's going to have the microphone clip, so we're all going to have to try to jerry-rig ways to hold the microphone.
No, you can find, I don't know, I found a used game shop that has a whole bunch of microphones in it. Like they keep it in the plastic, keep them in a plastic bag behind the counter, like $2 each.
And they had the clip.
No.
Yeah, that's
no.
The, that's the
you're gonna
part.
Have to jerry rig something, but yeah. Whatever.
Oh, fantastic!